undoubtedly the best thing about producing The Real Podcast is that it offers the chance to meet and natter with absolute experts on a whole variety of subjects. And in this new episode, we're going to chat to Real's tea partner, a chap called Will Battle, who quite literally wrote the book on tea. And you can check that out yourself if you like. Go and look for the World Tea Encyclopedia in any good bookshop, and you'll find his name right there under the title. Excitingly, Will thinks that 2020 is really tea's time. The humble cuppa on which the UK seems to so heavily depend, well, it's having a bit of a moment. For us, it's a vital ingredient in the production of our exquisite drinks, but it seems that the world is quite rapidly waking up to the possibilities that this wonderfully versatile plant offers. Whether that's from a foodie perspective, or of course from a health perspective. So it seemed like the right time to catch up with Will and ping him with questions relating to everything tea. Over the next hour or so, we'll look at the history of tea, some of the origins and legends, what different teas mean to different cultures, what it takes to grow a certain type of tea, and why one small pot of tea was once worth more than Richard Nixon's limousine. And finally, what, in Will's opinion, of course, the tea world will look like in 2020. So we'd suggest you put on a brew and put your feet up. But you know what? It's all a bit more fascinating than that. So we're here today to chat about tea, and we're here with Will Battle, who is Real's... well, tea partner, I suppose, is the best way to describe you.
Yeah, I think so, John. I mean, I've been with the team from the start, really, and yeah. I see my role as to make sure that the brewers have the right quality of tea in the right quantity. Hmm. And actually, it's a fantastic job.
What I'm really interested in is, I suppose, the boffin nature of what you do. I suppose most people assume that they know what they're talking about when they're talking about tea. But actually what they tend to be talking about in this country is sort of just bunging a tea bag into a cup and doing that maybe five or six times a day, and that's the end of that. But it's far more complex than that. And what I thought would be great is to chat to you. I'm going to pretend I know absolutely nothing. And in that way, our audience can learn a bit about what we're talking about. So I guess the first question is, how do you become a tea guru, if that's not too embarrassing a term for you?
Yeah, well, it sort of happens by accident. I don't know anyone who set out to become a tea guru or really almost any other guru. I mean, I come from a farming family, and I knew that I wanted to do something that was not conventional. And what I love about tea is that interplay between the agricultural element of it, the artisanal element of it, and then the foodie part. Mm. And then on the top of that, you've sort of got to understand the markets as well. And that makes it a very varied and very, very personal industry. And you've got to know a lot of people in order to do your job properly. Mm. And that personal element's also just great fun. Mm. But I think doing it well is about taking a real interest in what makes a tea good, whether it's the soil or the aspect or the seasonality or the guy who's actually the artisan who's making it. All of those things are just really important. And I think learning more, the more you learn, the more you realise you don't know.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that makes it so interesting, is that you never really stop learning.
Yeah, absolutely. But from what I understand of you is that you didn't set out to become a tea person, did you? You kind of accidentally fell into it. Is that the case?
Yeah, and I left university, and I'm a linguist by trade.
Oh, right, okay.
But I just sort of fell into it. I fell into a trainee role at Tetley, which was fantastic. Mm. And I spent my time training in India. I spent a year training in India and Sri Lanka, Kenya, Malawi. And it was just fantastic. I mean, who else gets the job of training in those parts of the world when all of your contemporaries are doing their accountancy exams? it's fantastic. And as I say, the people that you meet are always interesting. Mm. And I don't think there's a job like it, really. And I don't want to be sort of sniffy about our coffee colleagues, but the two industries are quite different, although they're often lumped together. And in tea, that personal element is really important because it's not an exchange-traded commodity. So the relationships you make are is that bit more interesting and that bit more important to you?
So when you're going off and looking at sort of certain tea gardens or something like that, it's as much about the relationship that you build with a particular grower. Is that the right term?
Yes, I think so. A producer.
A
perhaps.
Producer.
That makes
you decide which one to go to, I suppose.
Yeah, it's important to build lots of relationships as well, because any part of the world can have some natural problem. Heaven forbid it happens to someone you know or one of your suppliers, but you've always got to make sure that if the quality's not there, for whatever reason, that your customers can always get exactly the quality of tea that they want. Mm-hmm. So building multiple relationships and really understanding what makes a producer tick is really important. Mm-hmm. I think also trying to be there for the long term for your partners in producing countries as well. I'm a big believer that that the best tea comes from enduring relationships.
And if
you can be with a producer through thick and thin, then you generally end up with better tea at the end of it, because they know year in, year out what they need to do to make the sort of tea that you want. Say, for example, for real, we know we need some fantastic first flush Darjeeling, early season Darjeeling. And if you can buy that year after year, then that producer knows they can rely on you as a buyer.
Sure, yeah.
And those relationships, therefore, are really important that they're enduring. So that I think it improves the quality of the end product.
Right. When you started out, did you know what you were looking for in a quality tea? Was that something that you had to learn in terms of developing, a taste profile and an understanding of that profile?
I think it's about understanding your customer.
Right.
Because not everybody has the same taste. So, for example, take kombucha. And not every fantastic tea will automatically make a fantastic booch.
Mm-hmm.
And understanding what the customer needs is more important. So I don't necessarily think that my taste is always reflected in what my customers want or what is expensive. So I think understanding the application is more important. So, for example, if I were to offer a tea to someone who likes an English breakfast tea, they will probably want to drink it with milk. And therefore the parameters that are important for that customer are that the tea looks lovely when it's got milk in it. It looks bright and golden,
of course,
pinkish.
Yeah.
And that it's strong enough to stand up to an English breakfast. So you can stand up to the spicy HP sauce or sausages or whatever, and it works on those levels.
Whereas
if I'm offering a tea to someone who's going to perhaps having an afternoon tea, you need something that perhaps might go without milk. And you'll therefore pick a very different tea.
Yeah.
But the end product, they're both fantastic teas.
Of course,
one's
yeah.
not either perhaps better than the other. They're just designed for the application that they're going to be consumed in.
Of course, yeah.
And as a tea expert, it's your job really to understand what your customer wants and to try and deliver that. Because that's a key sort of trying to translate that brief is quite important.
I imagine there's a similarity, and it may seem like a very obvious similarity, but between a tea expert and a wine expert in terms of the ability to, I suppose, your palate, the quality of your palate, or is...
And I think perhaps there might be similarities, yes. I mean, we've both got to be good tasters.
Yeah.
The analysis of tea's not that different in the sense that it's not just about the tasting of it. I mean, tasting's a pejorative term because you're actually looking as much as you are tasting.
Right.
The aroma is really important. The finding faults so that you don't buy that sort of tea. All of those things are common to tea and wine and coffee to an extent, although coffee, the appearance is less important. But as tea experts, we're also interested in the leaf. Because you need to make sure that if you're assembling a blend, that you don't have a bricks and sand phenomenon. That you know, if you blend the two together, they're more or less the same size. And you have to, I think, also understand, a little bit about how that tea is going to be used. So if it's going to go into a tea bag, and not all tea bags are bad, incidentally, you can have some fantastic tea bags. It's going to go into a tea bag. You know, will it fit in the bag? That's something as basic as that. So all of those things go into your job as a tea taster.
Okay, then. So, I mean, this is the most basic trick question, but it seems to trip a lot of people up. What's the difference between a green tea plant, a black tea plant, and a white tea plant?
It's a good one, John. Actually, it's one I get asked a little bit. really there's no difference. They all, green tea, black tea, white tea, there's also yellow tea, oolong tea and dark tea. They all come from the same bush, Camellia sinensis. But it's what you do to the leaf that you've plucked from that bush that can create a green or a black or a white or a yellow tea. All six types of tea could come from one bush. But you do tend to find certain parts of the world have evolved strains or varieties of bush that are best orientated about making a green tea or a black tea. Yeah. So, for example, the real kombucha dry dragon is a longjing. Mm. And there's a variety that to the naked eye doesn't look any different to a tea bush in any other part of the world, but Longjing number 43 is a varietal that specifically makes fantastic quality dragon well tea. You wouldn't think to make black tea out of it, although you could if you wanted to.
Right, because it's essentially the same plant.
Yes.
I mean, I think that's the interesting thing in this country is that we assume that we know so much about tea because we... Is it the case that we drink the most in the world? I read that stat somewhere.
Per head, I think in Ireland they're still drinking more than they are in the UK.
Right, okay. The Irish are drinking more. Didn't know that.
The Turks drink a lot, but we're up there.
Yeah. Up there, but we just don't seem to know so much about it, and it does surprise me the amount of time that you'll say to somebody, actually, it's the same plant, and they're what? How can that be possible?
Yeah, one of the things that I always think in as I look at us in the UK drinking tea, is that we sort of claim an ownership of tea in a little bit. I mean, it's called English breakfast, and often we think that perhaps we've got a responsibility as sort of guardians of the beverage in some way. Whereas in fact, every country have their own tea tradition. And you know, whether it's our own tradition over here or take, for example, there's a small part of Germany called Ostfriesland.
Okay.
A little bit in between the Dutch border and Bremen. And they drink more tea per head there in that small part of Germany than we do over here. Wow. And they drink it with cream. India and Pakistan, this lovely tradition of the chai boiled tea boiled in milk with a bit of water added, spices, sweetened, buffalo milk. That's still tea. Mm. And who's to say it's any better or worse than our own tea tradition? Mm. And one of the things I love about tea is that versatility.
Right, yeah.
And the fact that going further east, we've got this amazing Japanese tea ceremony suffused with all sorts of codes of practice and tradition.
Absolutely.
And the fact that that is the same plant as has made our English breakfast tea or has made the chai in Calcutta that's drunk from a clay cup, I think that is the beauty of this product.
What is it about tea that has made people want to celebrate it in ceremony and ritual so often?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and I wish I knew. All I do know is I'm very glad people do. It lends an importance to something which otherwise is in danger of being sort of a bit commoditized.
And
I really like that people do celebrate it in that way.
Yeah, yeah, it's a wonderful thing. I spent a lot of time in Japan, and you know, that is one of the first things you're taken to see when you first arrive in Japan as somebody going to work there. Somebody locally will take you to a tea ceremony, and I have to admit that it slightly baffled me every time I went to see it. But as you say, there's a loveliness about the fact that, you know, essentially they're celebrating this plant.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic, and I've always enjoyed my participation in Japanese tea ceremonies. I'm not as flexible as my hosts usually, so there's normally some reorientation of my legs needed halfway through, and I'm always never quite understood why the Japanese didn't get into cricket, because it lasts about as long often as a cricket match. But it is absolutely, for me, sums up the sort of East Asian approach to tea, the respect with which the product is held.
Of course.
Yeah. And I... little things like just seeing the reverence with which the tea's handled by the hostess
is for me
that is something that everyone could do with watching, because it gives a newfound sort of sense of gravitas to the product.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
And it sort of marks quite how artisanal it is, and I really enjoy seeing that sort of reverence and respect for the product.
Why haven't we got that kind of thing over in this country? Seeing as we drink so much of it, and as you say, we sort of tend to almost see that we have some kind of ownership over it. You know, the most common thing I hear, and this terrible thing to say, but I often, you know, end up making builder's tea for friends and that kind of thing. Why are the Japanese celebrating it so wonderfully and we're making builders?
I don't know. I think we celebrate it in our own way. Hmm. And we don't always respect it as much as we could. Hmm. But there's something British about having a crisis and putting the kettle on. And to me, the respect lies in the quality of the tea you use to make that cup of tea.
Right.
To give someone tea and sympathy.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
All of that sort of thing, I think, is a respect for the product. It's just, I think, making sure that if I offer a builder a cup of tea, I'll try and offer them something fantastic that is still loosely defined as builder's tea, but it's got really, really lovely Rwandan high-grown tea and with a little bit of a Sam and some Ceylon. And it's still a builder's tea, but it's just a good builder's tea. and I think that's respect for the product. And so perhaps we do have that respect. It's just demonstrated a bit differently.
When I've travelled abroad, you know, I've often found people, if I get into a conversation about tea, you'll sometimes find people sort of being a bit sniffy about the fact that English people drink it so much with milk and that kind of thing. Is there a reason why we ended up doing that? That you know, we don't treat it in quite the same sort of pure way that other countries maybe do?
Yeah, I think it's a very good question. It's one I've tried for years to answer because I spent a long time living in the Netherlands.
And you've literally written the book.
Yeah, so I've tried to answer it in my book, actually. And the Brits, the Canadians, Antipodeans, Indians, Pakistan, we drink tea with milk. Mm. And one theory is that really the first people to start drinking tea with milk were the Indians, because a lot of tea, when it was coming out of China, might have been traded through India, sort of transshipped through India. There's long been a sort of tradition of using buffalo milk in India, and therefore that might have been one of the reasons that we discovered it. But I prefer the theory that when tea came into the UK in mass, it came from Assam.
Right.
Okay. And then later Ceylon, Sri Lanka. Assam tea, if you try and drink it without milk, is quite a mouthful.
Right. Okay.
It's mouth-puckeringly astringent. And you really feel like you've almost had a meal. And you need milk to mellow that down.
Yeah.
My theory is that all of that early experience of tea in this country from Assam meant that we just evolved this tradition of drinking it with milk, because that's the only way to really mellow down that really strong character. Mm. And in an English breakfast tea, that you can stand your spoon up in, it's the Assam that makes you be able to stand it, that brings you body and strength. Mm. Whereas our continental neighbours, say the Dutch, they'd have got their tea from China and Indonesia. And Indonesian tea, you don't really want to put milk in it. If you put milk in it, it'll look grey. Mm. It won't taste of anything. Mm. So why use milk? And I lived in the Netherlands long enough to know that they love milk in the Netherlands. They'll drink milk with anything. You have lunch in the Netherlands, there's always two types of milk on show and no water. So they really love milk, but they've never found the need to use it in their tea because the teas that they were trading and never really warranted it. And then the Dutch, being such inveterate traders, sent their tea to France and to Germany and in other parts of Europe. And that brought a sort of, generally a sort of a style of tea drinking that didn't warrant milk. So that's my theory, is that we've evolved because of the sort of those long, distant historical relationships.
In this country, though, I get the impression that, I guess we're starting to see this change in the way that people are approaching tea. You know, I'm hearing much more about people seeing tea as the exquisite product that perhaps it is, and, you know, talking about more about sparkling teas, and, you know, we talk about it as an alternative to alcohol, and I think more and more people are getting used to the idea that it could be that. What are you seeing from your side of things? You know, how is that changing, and why perhaps is that changing?
Yeah, I think it's tea's time at the moment.
Tea's time.
It is. Right. It's tea's time. Partly, in my view, partly because it's been more difficult for tea to find its place, because people assume that everyday tea bags are tea and that there's nothing else to it. There's no other dimension. So perhaps fighting that preconception has been more difficult for tea than it has been for coffee, where perhaps people came from soluble coffee into the more interesting and exciting barista world.
Absolutely, yeah.
Whereas tea has been more difficult for people to readjust their mental approach to it. And it's such a versatile product, John, that the application, people are realizing that the applications are enormous. And just that what we were talking about earlier with the fact that there's six different types of tea, and there's your greens, and even within green tea, you've got your steamed green teas and your pan-fired green teas. You've got oolongs of every different type. You've got all sorts of black teas. And I think the variety there means there's an almost limitless set of applications for tea, including your sparkling teas and your really high-end speciality teas to be drunk in tea shops, or almost boundless. If you go to some Burmese restaurants, you can have tea as a salad now. And it's a big speciality in Burma. So there's almost limitless application. And I think people are only now just discovering that and scratching the surface of what is actually runs quite deep.
Scroll back a second. You said that people have it as a salad. So they're eating the leaves raw and fresh. Is that what you mean?
Or
is
they're more pickled.
Pickled.
Yeah. And as you sometimes see it, Burmese students studying for their exams, it's their pro plus.
Really?
No, it keeps you going a bit longer. But it's a big speciality in Myanmar. And what I love about that is it just shows the versatility of the product. But I don't propose to start selling tea for eating over here. But it's
you heard it here first.
It is such
pickled tea coming to a restaurant near you.
You'd be quite close to the source of the production, I think, if you're pickling your recently plucked green tea. But that's sort of emblematic of that versatility that's there in the product, and I love that. And kombucha's arguably the most exciting application, particularly from the perspective of sort of out of home consumption at the moment. Really exciting.
Well, we get onto kombucha a little bit in more depth in a moment, but I wanted to ask you a little bit about the way that tea is being used as that alternative to alcohol. I mean, obviously kombucha is a large part of that, but do you think there's something inherent in the way that tea tastes that lends itself to that? I mean, we talk a lot about mouthfeel. We talk a lot about, obviously astringency.
I think one of the reasons people often move to tea is there's the health perception. If you're not drinking, then often it's because you want to embrace a healthier lifestyle. And tea and health are, they go hand in hand, really. It is a healthy product. Part of that is the health element, and green tea especially, because of the catechins in green tea. There's a lot of work to suggest that green tea is good for your cardiovascular system. So I think part of it's health, and part of it's that variety story that you can find a tea for everybody. I'm confident that if you don't like tea, you come to me, I could probably find a tea for most people.
That would be an interesting challenge.
But
you know what? Sorry to jump in, but we actually find this quite a lot with kombucha, is that we'll serve somebody a glass of kombucha and say, go on, try that. And they'll say, oh, I don't like tea. I'm not going to like this. And they completely don't see the tea or don't taste the tea. Or even if they do, they've found that it's in a fermented format, it's something that they can absolutely get involved with.
Well, that's exciting. I think that's actually not too dissimilar to some of the stories I could tell you about people who say they don't like tea, and then you show them an oolong, and they say, "Where have you been all my life?" They thought that tea was your humdrum tea bag, and it's not. There's more and more of that, and I see more and more. And there's lots of stories about the UK tea market in decline, but that is a very distinct part of the market, and there's lots of really exciting high quality variety teas that are really growing in demand, and if I look at the shelves of the supermarkets now, you see so much more variety than you used to 20 years ago.
That must be incredibly exciting for you.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's great to see. It really is. It's fantastic. Yeah, it's just exciting that people recognize that there's a lot more out there than people had previously thought.
Mm-hmm. We're about to get into a period, I suppose, of harvest. We've talked a little bit. You've mentioned Real Kombucha's Royal Flush, and that we use a first flush Darjeeling. And as I understand it, that harvest period comes towards the end of February. So just around the time that this podcast's going to be hitting the podcast shelves, so to speak. Tell me a little bit about Darjeeling and about Darjeeling first flush. What does the first flush part mean?
Yeah, I think we'd probably expect our teas to come right at the beginning of March. The flush is a period of growth, and the first flush is the first period of growth that the tea bush experiences during the year. Mm. Now, if you think about a tea bush in Darjeeling, it's probably to around about 2,000 metres above sea level, so really high, higher than anywhere in the British Isles.
Yeah.
And it's just endured a period of immense stress through the winter.
Right, okay.
There are other tea plantations around the world that are at 2,000 metres in Rwanda, in South India, in Kenya. But what makes Darjeeling special is its proximity to the Himalayas. Mm. So you've got these very cold winds coursing south from the Himalayas through the valleys.
Mm-hmm.
Our estates in Teesta Valley, for example. Mm. And those cold winds bring stress to the bush. Mm. And as the bush tries to protect itself, it creates these unique compounds in the leaf that you can taste when you eventually taste the tea that's been plucked from those leaves.
What are those compounds? What are you tasting? I'm fascinated to know what you're tasting tasting that I don't know.
What would it taste like? It would taste sort of geranium-y,
right,
jasmine-y,
right.
A sort of zesty, fresh character.
Mm.
So the other end of the taste spectrum from malty, more floral and in a sort of floral direction.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a sort of aromatic quality.
Okay.
The other thing is that the leaf is quite dry when it's you haven't had much rain over the last few months, and most of the rain in Darjeeling will come during the sort of the July, August, September months.
Mm-hmm.
So the leaf being very dry, they'll pluck it and take it to the factory.
Mm-hmm.
And in the factory, typically when you're making a black tea, they'll wither it. In other words, just leave it on a trough to blow air through it and take the moisture down in the leaf.
Mm.
And they'll, in Darjeeling for the first flush, they'll give it what we call a very hard wither, which takes more moisture out of the leaf and gives it, you retain more of the character of that leaf,
right,
in the manufacture process. So essentially what it means is that when you put it through the next stages in tea manufacture, which is a rolling and then an oxidation process, you end up with something which is more like a green tea than a black tea. Although it is by definition a black tea, it ends up looking and tasting a bit more like a green tea, which is a very unique character that comes only in the first flush because of the combination of the previous winter and then this dryness in the leaf, which I think is really unique. And it gives us really this character that you can't find anywhere else. And I think that's what the wine trade would call terroir, the interplay of all sorts of different influences that give a unique characteristic to that particular tea.
So mentally, I'd like you to go to Teesta Valley and tell me, standing in the tea gardens, what you can see. What does that region look like?
Well, you'll see tea clinging to the slopes. Mm. You'll see bits of forest on some of the ridges. Mm. And you'll see, this time of year, the end of February, beginning of March, you'll see pluckers start to appear and come into the tea gardens. You'll see small tracks that the plantation need in order to take that leaf off to the factory.
Mm.
You'll see quite small tea factories perched on hillsides that are much smaller in appearance and everything within that factory, because of the topography in Darjeeling, has to be sort of much more sort of almost toy town in nature.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that because it gives quite an artisanal feel to what in some parts of the world can be a slightly industrialized process. Mm. And it means that batch by batch attention to detail is really important in Darjeeling. Mm. And that's really, really exciting. Mm. So, yeah, it's a great tourist destination. So it's an attractive place to be. Mm. And you'll find lots of people traveling there for their holidays. And because it's beautiful and tea's a lovely crop to look at as well.
Mm-hmm. So the difference between Darjeeling and the region that you're from where you're buying Dragonwell green tea, which is in China, is very different, I suppose, in topography, but also in culture. Is the tea culture particularly different between the two?
Yeah.
Are there similarities that you see?
There's some similarities in that, generally speaking, strangely for India, a higher proportion of the bushes in Darjeeling are a so-called China varietal. So they're the original sort of narrow-leafed bush that's native to China. So that they have that in common. Mm. But generally speaking, the Dragonwell area is a little flatter. Mm-hmm.
Are we talking about the same sort of height?
No, it's lower. Lower mm-hmm. down. Not very far away from Hangzhou in China is where you'd find the Dragonwell areas. You probably would also find that those areas are, there's probably more sole trader artisans operating there than there are in Darjeeling.
Yeah.
So in Darjeeling, you'll have an estate or a garden and a factory that might employ quite a few people, whereas there'll be more singletons, more family businesses in Hangzhou, which is also exciting because it's an exciting place to visit and to see these people making their own tea by hand that they've plucked themselves is a really exciting thing to witness as well. Mm. So as far as the industry is concerned, you probably find a slightly smaller scale industry in China in terms of the type of business that's functioning there. Not to say there aren't big businesses in China. There are. But particularly for the artisanal products, exciting small sort of family businesses.
Mm. And as I understand it, the Dragonwell, it's dried using a hand technique, is it not?
Yeah, there's a couple of things that make Dragonwell or Longjing what it is. Firstly, the area. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of areas where you can really grow tea that you will call Dragonwell.
Right, okay. It's a great name, isn't it?
It is, yeah, it is. It is a great name.
Is there a history in that name?
Well, there's all sorts of legend. Like for every tea in China, there's a legend. Mm-hmm. And you can pick almost any tea and there's a story behind it. Mm-hmm. And it often involves the emperor and normally it ends happily. But the handmade element of it's quite important. The main difference between, say, the first flush Darjeeling and the Longjing is that the Darjeeling is a black tea and the Dragonwell is a green tea. Mm. And green teas have gone through a process in which the enzymes in the leaf have been deactivated. Mm. And to deactivate an enzyme in a leaf, you need to expose it to heat.
Right.
So the heat in China in this Dragonwell tea comes from a wok. Essentially, and now ordinarily an electric heated wok, that the artisanal producer he's dropping his green leaf, his recently plucked leaf, into the wok, rubbing it up against the sides of the wok, and then gathering it up and scattering it down again into the wok, and then he goes through this process again where he's rubbing it up against the sides of the wok.
How long would the tea spend in the wok?
It could spend about 20 minutes in there.
Okay, so
and that creates from the classic two leaves and a bud tea that we all see in sort of pictures of tea plantations. It creates a sort of sword shape, and that sword shape is the sought after characteristic of Longjing, and you can almost taste that process,
right?
Because the deactivation of the enzyme is heat, and that gives a slight toastiness often to the final product. Yeah. And every product's a bit different because it's so artisanal, and that's exciting.
Yeah.
But the skilled artisan who can finish his tea in those 20 minutes is the expert. Because if you take too long, you've perhaps over overheated it, and you might end up with a more toasty tea that people don't necessarily want. You lose some of those aromatic top notes. But someone who doesn't do it for long enough, you probably don't really have a stable product at the end of it. Right. So those guys, it's experience handed down from generation to generation that makes it so
exciting.
That's
the stuff that I really love. Are they able to feel when it's done? I suppose if it's that tactile, they're right in there, they're pressing it up, they must get used to it, but it must be a mixture of smells and feels.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
And as you say, experience.
It is all about, it's a multi-sensory way of working out whether your tea is done. And it's an experience even just to look at the hands of the people who are making
it.
But the
burn marks everywhere. if I was doing it,
yeah. Well, they certainly bear the hallmarks of someone who's spent a lot of time working with their hands. But the it's partly the aroma, but also every day's different. If you've just had rain overnight, you perhaps have to wait a little bit before you pluck your tea and start to make it, but you'll still have to treat it differently in that manufacture process than you would have done on a hot day. And all of those things come into the mind of the artisan when he's making the tea, he or she is making the tea. You can taste different approaches to trying to come to make Dragonwell. So they weren't all created equally.
With the Dragonwell artisan, we were just saying, you know, it's very tactile. It's very much about a multi-sensory experience in the way that it's produced. Are there similarities in Darjeeling tea in that they would have certain abilities and things that they're looking out for? What would they be?
There's various varietals that they'll look for in Darjeeling. So there's quite a lot of work that goes into development of cultivars that will work particularly well in different applications. So a cultivar, like in the wine industry, you might have lots of different cultivars of Pinot Noir.
Right.
In tea, the China varietal tea bush, you could have different cuttings and propagate them in order to try and make the most of different qualities. So for example, say you There's a characteristic on second flush Darjeeling tea, which is a muscatel taste.
Okay.
A sort of slightly grapey taste, fruity taste. And certain varietals give more of that taste. Mm. So in Darjeeling, part of the expertise is in creating tea, creating plant material that can give you the sort of taste that you want to have. And that's quite exciting. Mm. And you'll get similar development happening in China for the Dragonwell. But there are also people in Darjeeling making exciting and interesting green teas as well. It's a typical, Darjeeling is known as a black tea origin, but you get some very exciting green teas and oolong teas made there as well by artisans. So it's not all black and white. There's lots of shades of grey in there. And you can walk into a factory and find a few people making making something that looks very Chinese in style in Darjeeling. So it's not just, and you're very close to the border up there as well. So it's a sort of slightly grey area in many respects.
Just to spin back a bit, can you give me a very brief potted history of how the tea plant spreads? It starts off, am I right in thinking it comes from China originally? It's not actually, it doesn't actually originate up in Darjeeling at all, does it? It's been brought there.
No, there's two subspecies of Camellia sinensis. The Chinese subspecies, which we think is native, we don't know for sure, but we think is native to those sort of borderlands of China, Laos, Myanmar, that sort of part of the world. And then there's what we call the Assam Jat, a broader leaved tea bush, which you find planted in parts of India, Africa, elsewhere, that is native to that sort of Assam, so India and Myanmar sort of area. But that's the broad starting point for tea, those sort of borderlands between India, Laos and Myanmar and China.
Okay. And more recently, Scotland and Cornwall, I've heard.
Yes, well, tea flourishes really anywhere where you can get a lot of rain. And right. John, you need a lot of rain. I mean, I live in Lincolnshire, which is one of the driest counties of the country. And we had a very, very wet year last year. We had about 800, 900 millimetres of rain. And it's still not enough to grow tea. Right. That's why Scotland, Wales, Cornwall are where you find Tea Gardens in Jersey as well. So anywhere where you get at least a metre, really, ideally 1.1 metre of rain.
Right. And are they flourishing in these parts of the UK?
It's still, you have to speak to the growers, but it's still pretty marginal. And you do need also, ideally, a bit of heat. And
we don't have much.
We don't quite as much as they have in more tropical countries. But in Tregothan, for example, in Cornwall, they've been growing camellias for years. And the family have had a long tradition of growing fantastic camellias, and tea is a camellia. And so they've done very well at growing them. But it's still hard, and the yields are not what you would get in a in an African or an Indian estate.
Of course,
and if you want that tea, you have to pay up for it, rightly so, because you're not going to get the same yield from a bush as you would in somewhere with a bit more rain and a bit more heat.
You've talked a lot about Chinese green tea, because we're talking about Dragonwell in particular. What is the basic difference? Is there a basic difference between a Chinese and a Japanese green tea?
Yes, the difference lies in how the tea maker has decided to deactivate the enzymes in the leaf.
Right.
So if you're Chinese, you would expose it to direct heat in the form of that wok. So you'll be pressing the leaf up in some way against a hot surface, and that heat kills off the enzyme, and it means the leaf will stay green.
Yes.
Whereas the Japanese will steam it.
Right.
And that exposure to superheated steam is what then deactivates the enzyme. So you've got the steam in Japan and you've got the direct heat in China, and that gives you two very different tastes at the end of the day. And you tend to see that steam is a more efficient way of deactivating the enzymes. So when you look at Japanese teas, they tend to be green teas, they tend to be paler in colour. The Chinese teas, it might take that artisan 20 minutes to deactivate the enzymes fully. So there's a little bit of oxidation that's happened in that 20 minutes. So they tend to be slightly more off-white in colour. So perhaps more like an oaky Chardonnay in colour.
Right, okay.
Than the Japanese green teas.
We hear a lot of these, I suppose what you'd call origin stories around, certainly around kombucha. There's origin stories around how kombucha may be several thousand years old, and often you hear about it being, you know, having been brewed by an emperor and given to his people because he called it the elixir of life. And I'll be honest, I'm slightly suspicious of those. Have you ever come across anything that would document a sort of history of fermented tea or anything like that?
No, I haven't, John. I mean, your story marries with mine that this emperor had presented his subjects with the elixir of life. And it sounds like kombucha. But every tea that I buy from China has a legend attached to it. And those legends are invaluable marketing stories. They're brilliant. There is not a tea really that I've come across without some sort of a legend, and even the growth of tea, the father of tea, Emperor Shennong, is credited with so many accomplishments that some of them must not have been true. And he was the man who was this epic herbalist who catalogued and documented numerous edible plants. In fact, his demise was because he tasted a plant that turned out not to be edible. that did for him. But you know, he's also credited with inventing the plough, the farmer's market, and so many other things that I'm not sure all of those stories can be credible
in.
That's what I love about any sort of product that comes from China, that legend, that lovely thing where you... doesn't matter if it's not true,
really.
It's a fantastic product anyway, and it fits the story. And I really like that. There's a lovely story about how oolong was developed. And oolong's a lovely product in which the edge of the leaf has been bruised. And the centre of the leaf is unbruised. So that, in a way, the edge of the leaf is sort of almost a black tea, and the centre of the leaf is almost a green tea. So it's a semi-fermented tea, semi-oxidised tea. And that is supposed to have evolved because a gentleman had plucked his tea bushes and he had his tea leaf in a basket on his back, and he then saw a deer which he wanted to hunt. And he got his slingshot or his bow and arrow out and shot at it. But it took some time to track down. And during that time he was having to run after it, and the agitation of the leaf in his back, in his basket, meant that the edges of the leaf were bashing up against each other and bruising each other. And that action created different taste in the resultant tea that was made at the end of it, this characteristic oolong taste. And eventually he got his deer, but also he got a very different tea in his basket at the end of it. And that's the legend about how oolong is supposed to develop. Don't know if that is actually how it happened, but I like the story.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, certainly when I was living in Japan, lots of parts of Japan would make claims to either be the first place where tea arrived in Japan, or interestingly enough, that it's always accepted that tea did come from China at some point, and it's nearly always connected with a Buddhist monk and a journey of that nature. But it's similarly, everybody makes the claims.
Yeah,
That's lovely.
That's great, isn't it, though?
Yeah.
It's exciting. And those Buddhist monks are actually common to a lot of Chinese tea stories as well. Mm. Lots of I think it was Isai, the monk who came.
Right,
and it's that community and their travel from monastery to monastery is quite a good way of broadcasting tea outside of where it was in its heartland, and it's been really invaluable to the spread of tea.
And the development of these things as well, I suppose. I mean, again, one of the things that I often saw in Japan was that you could travel almost the full length of the Shinkansen bullet train line from the south to the north, and almost every town would have its own specialist, like udon or something like that, and everybody had a reason why their udon was the best in Japan, or and nearly always there was some great story linked to it. But it just meant that you could actually have a really interesting food holiday where you could go from place to place and taste a whole variety of what essentially didn't really matter what the story was. Everybody was trying to make the very best product they possibly could, and you would end up with this amazingly storied and rich quality of food.
So exciting, John. And I think the other thing to add from my experience of Japan is that we forget what a long country it is and quite how many sort of climate zones you've got there.
Absolutely.
And that's one of the exciting things about Japanese tea is that whether or not you're on Honshu or a Kagoshima, you've got quite a big climatic variation between those two islands. And that creates really interesting variety in the produce.
Absolutely.
And I really enjoyed that part of Japan when I was there.
We're going to come back to Japan in a minute because you think there's something interesting going on there. But before we do that, I want to ask a rather silly little question concerning quality and money, I suppose. If I had all the money in the world and I had all the time in the world and I wanted to go and buy the most expensive tea, not necessarily the best quality of tea, but what is the most expensive? Where would you head me off to?
Well, there's lots of people who claim to make the most expensive tea in the world. One of the candidates is Da Hong Pao. Which is the tea that Chairman Mao famously presented Richard Nixon with when he visited China. And Nixon was famously difficult to please anyway. And he'd been given a small, I think he'd probably brought over a very expensive limo or something for Mao, and then Mao presented him with this 100 grams of tea or something. Nixon sniffed at it, and then Mao revealed that it was half of the whole production of China of that type of tea for that year, and probably worth something like $2 million.
Wow.
And I think that is tea valued for its rarity and snobbish value.
Yeah.
You can go to...
Have you tasted that?
I've tasted not that one. now, fortunately, you can get hold of something similar at a much more accessible price point.
And can you
taste
why it would be considered
that particular special tea is valued because it was really supposed to have come from four bushes on a sheer cliff face that's
very
difficult
to
get to.
And accessibility.
Those bushes have since had cuttings taken from them and they're propagated. But I do think the other candidates are, there's a type of tea from Yunnan province called Pu'er, which is a sort of post-fermented tea, which is sort of much like the Bordeaux wine market, is cellared, and then you see these peaks and troughs and bubbles developing as people try and speculate on the market, because it's one of the only teas that improves or is supposed to improve with age. So you get vast prices asked for very old Pu'er teas that have been cellared for a long period. But I'm a big believer that the best tea is the one that you like the most and is not necessarily the most expensive. If I were to go off and buy, money no object, buy a tea, I say this without any knowledge that real kombucha will make a first flush Darjeeling, but it would always be a first flush Darjeeling, really nice first flush, always. Probably invoice number one, the first one made that year. It's just the most evocative tea of the garden from which it's come. You can taste that stress in the bush from the winter period. And it's something that I'm lucky enough to be a tea importer, so I have access to it, and I just drink it every day. And I reckon I drink 30 kilos a year, probably. Or at least my office seems to get through 30
getting
kilos
high off
year.
Your own
it's
supply.
Just beautiful stuff.
So when you say invoice number one, that's literally the first that is the first flush.
So, for example, a tea garden won't be ready for plucking in all parts of the garden at exactly the same day. There'll be bits which are perhaps south-facing or whatever. And the very first batch of tea made on that estate in that factory.
And they're watching it day to day and taking it off on each day. And again, that's the artisanal thing, isn't it? It's the recognition and the understanding of what the difference between a day-to-day harvest is.
Yes, yeah. And to be fair, The quality difference, even for an expert taster, between DJ1, first invoice to be made that year, first batch, and batch number 20, it's quite difficult to taste the difference between all those 20. But yeah, if you're really being snobbish, you'll probably take the first one. But that is exactly the artisan's job. It's not just about being in the factory and doing something with your hands. It's about knowing your bushes and having that connection with the people who you're working with and plucking, and to make sure that everything works exactly as it should. All of those logistics and getting that leaf from the garden into the factory as quickly as possible, making sure you don't do any damage to it when you're getting it there. Yeah, you don't want to drive your four-wheel drive fast over those roads because you're agitating the leaf and you're losing control of the process. It's that whole interplay between the people plucking it, getting it to the factory, checking it when it arrives in the factory, looking after it.
Well, that's fascinating to me that you're even talking about, you know, that the journey in the back of a four-wheel drive could affect what the quality tastes like.
Yeah, teas, it famously leads to travel in business class. Otherwise, it will be, it won't forgive you if you put it in economy. Because tea doesn't like to be cramped or doesn't like to get too hot. If you dump all of your recently plucked leaf into a trailer and try and transport it to the factory, the stuff at the bottom will have the weight of everything in the trailer bearing down on it. And that's not good. You want to keep it cool, cool and have air around it, and generally not pressure and not heat. And all of that is the reason why teas are sort of a business class traveller rather than an economy class traveller when you're getting it from the garden to the factory.
Well, this is an absolute education. Here's me just thinking that I'm having, you know, I suppose even though I work with tea, I still have that upbringing around the idea of just a Tetley or a PG Tips or something that is just, you know, it's as English as my grandmother sort of thing. So to sort of see it in these terms is quite an education. We're in this period that we just sort of said before. You said you called it tea's time, which I think is a great little term. For 2020, we're right at the beginning of 2020 now. What do we have? What does tea's time look like? What are you excited about within the industry?
I think this year, I'm really excited about Japan. People are going to experience the Olympics this summer. And a lot of tea-related things. If you're a tea business and you're trying to specialise in something this year, the awareness that people will have for Japan will be heightened this year. And there will be, there's a great opportunity to look more at Japanese teas. I think the great thing about Japan is you don't have to contrive anything. The teas from Japan are just fantastic. And there's so much variety there. So I can see Japan has been quite big this year. I also think that we'll see more continued rise of Africa. And tea's a product that is growing enormously in Africa in terms of the amount of tea being cultivated there. And Africa's exciting because it's you've got these amazing, very high-grown areas. and but people are experimenting with how they make tea. There's new varietals like purple tea being grown in Africa. It's just it's a normal tea bush, but it's a anthocyanin rich tea bush, so it's got a distinctive appearance and a distinctive health claim attached to it. So things like that are going to be big. I think the field of oolong, although it only represents less than 5% of the world's tea, people are waking up to the opportunity and the variety that sits within that oolong area. You can have oolong teas that have been baked in an oven for a period of 2 weeks where there's very little caffeine left in the leaf. You've got a very smooth, toasty character that comes with the tea. And then you can have oolongs that taste of honeysuckle and lily and sweet pea and these amazing floral characters. And they're both oolongs, but they're almost chalk and cheese. And I think people are waking up to that variety as well. So I pick those three things as my things to watch, perhaps 2020, 2021. Yeah.
Brilliant. Thanks so much for your time.
Well, thank you, John.